Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Happy fiscal New Year's Eve, everybody. Champagne, party hats, and one big fat government shutdown. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 30th of September. But as we all know, it is not just your run-of-the-mill 30th of September. We find ourselves today, well, still nowhere. That's where we find ourselves. Unless things change in the next, what, 6, maybe 7 hours, parts of the federal government are going to go dark for an as-yet undetermined period of time. Marketplace's David Gura is in Washington, the center of the federal economic universe this week. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
All right, man. So what's the lay of the land right now?
Well, President Obama is due to speak any minute now. He's going to make some sort of statement about this. The latest in terms of procedural wrangling is that the House and the Senate have been going back and forth all weekend on spending bills. And this afternoon, the Senate rejected a House spending bill 54-46. And that's no surprise there. That bill would have funded the government if the government were to delay the Affordable Care Act for a year. There was talk this afternoon that there might be some sort of short-term stopgap spending bill to keep things going for a few more days so lawmakers could keep trying to hammer something out, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So Senate Democrats in the White House are sticking to what they've been saying the whole time, which is that they want a spending bill passed with no strings attached. Now it sounds like House Republicans are thinking they're going to pass the bill back to them one more time with some more provisions that would delay the implementation of parts of the president's health care law.
Hot potato, hot potato. Remind me, does any of this actually affect Obamacare, which is what I thought this whole thing was about anyway?
No, it doesn't. And I was on the phone with a few health policy experts this morning, and all of them emphasized this point, that tomorrow health insurance exchanges that are part of the president's health care law, they're going to open up across the country, and that's going to happen whether or not the government shuts down at midnight. So, no, it's not going to have any effect on implementation of Obamacare.
All right, let me try another question. Is this going to save any money, which is sort of also what this is about?
It's the same answer. It's no to that as well. And I mean, if we look back at those two big shutdowns from 95 and 96 when Bill Clinton was president, after those, the Office of Management and Budget did the math and they tried to assess sort of what happened and what didn't happen and what that cost us. And it came to almost $1.5 billion. And that's in 1996 money. So if you were to do it today, it'd be even more money than that. Those shutdowns lasted more than 20 days, so it really all depends here, Kai, on how long a shutdown could last. But the short answer to your question is no, it's not going to save us any money.
Well, talk to me. What do you hear about how long this might last? I mean, if it shuts down tonight, everybody's going to regroup and it'll be a couple of days of sitting around doing nothing. But then what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's anybody's guess right now. And I mean, I think the next step's going to be, sad as it is, that the blame game is going to start, or maybe it's going to continue. I mean, I think you're already seeing that happening, that lawmakers are sort of positioning themselves as who caused this, who may cause this, who did cause this, whatever. So, we're gonna have to wait and see. And I think it's anybody's guess how long it's going to take.
All right. One more thing before I let you go, David. On to the much more serious topic of the debt limit, which is set to expire. We're set to hit the debt limit on the 17th of October. How does all of this play into that, if at all?
Yeah, that's right. These fiscal crises come fast and furious. Coming up here in a couple of weeks. So, you know, I think that if Wall Street was at all convinced itself that Washington wasn't going to let this happen, this has kind of spooked them into thinking that maybe in just a couple of weeks, this might not get fixed. And this is, of course, the debt limit, the something that authorizes the government to pay the bills that it's racked up, something that's very serious and potentially what could have a much bigger effect on the U.S.'s credit rating and on its creditworthiness around the world.
Does this then increase the pressure? If there is a shutdown and neither side gets what it ostensibly wants out of this week, does it increase the political stakes on the debt limit issue?
I think so. But I think you could say that the Republicans, the House Republicans, sort of bet the barn on this particular fight, maybe to Speaker Boehner's chagrin. Who knows what will happen. But I do think it increases the stakes tremendously.
All right. David Gura in our Washington Bureau. More on this as it comes. The president, we should say, is speaking now. So next go around on Marketplace, we'll see what he says. All right, David, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
All right. Be good. You don't need a long memory to recall what happened the last time Congress was at an impasse over spending. It was, of course, just 2 years ago that the ratings agency Standard & Poor's stripped the U.S. of that coveted AAA rating. It said the uncertainty created by the fight over the budget merited a downgrade to AA. Well, this time around, S&P is saying that it won't cut America's credit rating again. Apparently, we're still all right at AA, but we don't deserve an upgrade, S&P says. On Wall Street today, well, let's just say it wasn't as bad as it could rightfully have been. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Royal Dutch Shell is packing up and going home, getting the heck out of South Texas. The company says it's going to sell its stake in the Eagle Ford Shale Formation down there. We're talking 106,000 acres sitting on top of who knows how many barrels and cubic feet of oil and natural gas reserves. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has a look now at why the company is backing away.
It's kind of like a country song. You've got a southern gem, in this case the Eagle Ford Shale Formation, who catches the eye of the international big spender, Shell. And then Shell decides the Eagle Ford Formation just isn't worth the time. Bye, 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 my baby, bye, bye. But before you pull out your Kleenex, you should know there are other suitors for Eagle Ford's oil and gas reserves. Thomas Tunstall is the research director for the Institute for Economic Development at the University of Texas at San Antonio. He says smaller, independent companies are the ones who really figured out how to get the oil and gas out of the shale.
Larger oil companies, I think, are still learning about them. They don't know as much about these production techniques as the independents do.
And, says Phil Flynn with the Price Futures Group in Chicago,
Shell was kind of late to the game when it came to the shale gas revolution.
And with the low price of natural gas, it's been hard for Shell to make money.
For Shell, at this point, it's small potatoes for them, and they want to focus on their core business.
So the company is out. David Goldwyn is the president of Goldwyn Global Strategies.
So I don't think the shale gas boom is in any danger of becoming a bust.
But he says right now the demand just isn't there for a company like Shell to stick with the investment, even if it's hard to walk away. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
As Washington grapples with its budget and what has become a rather dramatic countdown to a government shutdown, here in New York, an opera company is grappling with a budget drama of its own. The New York City Opera needs to raise $7 million by the end of today or close its doors for good. They've even tried a $1 million Kickstarter campaign for an opera company, that is. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
You have to admit, it sounds like an opera plot. A 70-year-old company, launchpad of greats like Placido Domingo and Beverly Sills, might vanish forever at the stroke of midnight. George Steele is the opera's general manager and artistic director.
We have no cash, we have no credit, and we have been skirting cash flow pitfalls every week since I got here, and it's finally caught up with us.
The New York City Opera's latest show, Anna Nicole, based on the life of Anna Nicole Smith, has been selling out.
Come to me for your breast augmentation.
But ticket sales cover less than a third of a company's expenses, says Mark Skorka, president of Opera America.
It was George Bernard Shaw who said that opera is the most expensive invention of man, second only to war.
And art institutions are increasingly at war over a shrinking pool of donors. And most of them are giving to big established names like the New York Metropolitan Opera. That could mean the end of many smaller companies, which tend to be more financially accessible. New York City opera tickets start at $25. Aram Sinreich is a media professor at Rutgers University.
That means that middle-class people won't have any relationship to live opera as an art form at all.
All New York City Opera can do now is hope for a big donor to come to the rescue in the final act. Otherwise, says the opera's artistic director, George Steele,
tomorrow the company will begin filing bankruptcy papers, and a great company, a center of the country's artistic life, will be no more.
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
As As Mr. Gura and I were talking about as we got going today, whether the government is open tomorrow or not, the curtain's finally going to go up on a key part of the Affordable Care Act. The online insurance exchanges open for business tomorrow. And the stakes, it's safe to say, are pretty high. If Obamacare were a movie, tomorrow would be it. The only day that Hollywood cares about. What does the box office say? But how much does opening day matter for the exchanges? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer checks that out for us.
If you're producing a big, expensive movie like the new Hunger Games sequel, you need to make a huge splash right away. So you start promoting the film months in advance with trailers that promise lots of action.
The 75th Hunger Games!
The fate of a would-be blockbuster hangs not on opening day, but on a film's opening hours. Peter Broderick is a film distribution strategist.
After the first show, we know.
Broderick says it's make or break.
What do I need to do?
Stay alive.
A studio may have a plan and hopes for a movie, and then if it does very poorly to start with, how much are they going to support it along the way?
Especially if people are telling their friends how awful it was. Joe Neuberger teaches marketing at the Wharton School. He says the debut of the healthcare exchanges is like any new product launch. Word of mouth will be extremely important.
The first time the Swiffer comes out, for example, what's a Swiffer? People look to see, well, do others like this product or not? Is this movie good? Is it getting good reviews?
But the healthcare exchanges will enter opening day with a disadvantage new movies and products don't have. The exchanges are already getting bad reviews from opponents of healthcare reform who've spent millions and millions on ads like this one, which features a leering Uncle Sam in a gynecologist's office. Len Nichols is a healthcare economist at George Mason University. He says if the exchanges have a good opening day, people could pile in fast. But he says even if opening day is a mess, it won't be like at the movies.
And let's just say they call and the first day there's a glitch. They're not going to say, okay, then I'm never going to get health insurance. They're going to call back in a week.
Nichols says the exchanges don't have an opening day. They have an opening 6 months. Plenty of time to make a first impression. Not to mention, if you're uninsured, they may be the only show in town. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
For most of us, tomorrow is just another Tuesday. Breakfast, kids off to school, work, unless you're affected by the shutdown, that is. But Aquiline Lori has had tomorrow circled on her calendar for more than a year because she is one of millions of Americans under the age of 65 with a pre-existing health condition. That means she's one of millions of Americans who've had to go without health insurance until signups for those exchanges start tomorrow. From the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has her story.
We've all had dizzying moments, those periods when we just don't recognize ourselves. The roads were hurtling down.
Calls starting to come in. When are you going to pay this? When are you going to pay that? I had no way of paying anything.
When she was 34, Aquiline Lori, a marketing consultant, spent a week in an Atlanta hospital where surgeons removed her gallbladder.
I was trying to start year two of my business, and then I was, you know, sitting here while I'm trying to recover, thinking about this insurance company ditching me.
It turns out Lori's insurer, who she just signed on with, didn't check her medical history until after the claims started rolling in. They termed her genetic blood disorder a pre-existing condition and ripped up her policy, sticking her with a $50,000 bill.
The fire and the anger that I have for that insurance company that did that to me, they and others like them do that every day to people and get away with it. How do you fight that?
Most people don't have to. As many as 82 million Americans with pre-existing conditions get their insurance at work, so they can't be denied. And that was Lori's story for a while, working for a hot startup in Cambridge, years at Procter & Gamble. Then she went out on her own and joined the 25 million Americans with pre-existing conditions who don't have coverage. Since then, Lori's bounced on and off insurance, a dangerous proposition for her.
In May, I just had a heart attack. And it was, I believe, a result of not getting the maintenance that I was supposed to be maintaining with for my genetic blood disorder.
Lori says it's lucky her coverage, even though it's temporary, had just kicked in. Without that card, there's no way she would have gone to the hospital to find out why she was in pain.
I would have continued to say, well, you know what, let me find another remedy. Well, maybe I should take, you know, some medicine. Maybe it's indigestion. Maybe it's I was coming up with anything other than a heart attack.
Lori says being uninsured because of a pre-existing condition forces you to make choices rationally you'd never make. Starting Tuesday, it won't matter anymore.
I would never have imagined decisions I was making about, well, yeah, I guess you should take my gallbladder because I don't want to have to fight, you know, the insurance company about that situation. I mean, to not have to make those types of decisions about my body, that's what October 1st represents.
Lori admits she has no idea what plans she'll find on Virginia's exchange tomorrow. Maybe they'll be too expensive. Maybe there'll be glitches. But at least she'll have a choice. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, pay attention to this one, people.
Not enough of us who have had some success are willing to really admit how little we actually know about what we're doing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Wall Street is none too pleased with the shenanigans going down in Washington. The Dow Industrials raised 128 points, 0.8%, landed at 15,129. The NASDAQ knocked off 10 points, 0.25%, 3771. The S&P 500 also fell 10 points, 0.6%, 1681. There for the month, the Dow was up 2%. The S&P 500 added 3%. The NASDAQ drove up 5%. Today's losses, though, were felt across the board. Consumer products giant Procter & Gamble washed away 2%. Coca-Cola drained 1.3%. Financial, energy, and other basic resources all ticked down. H&R Block added 1% today. The tax preparer may benefit from Obamacare because people who qualify for a government subsidy under that law will be required to file a tax return. Angie's List scratched off nearly 6% today. Word is that the chief technology officer is no longer with that company. JCPenney took off more than 2.5%, landed at its lowest stock price since 1982. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.61%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for August. A reminder to eat your vegetables. October is Spinach Lovers Month. And on October 1st, 1968, the black and white horror flick Night of the Living Dead premiered. It has since been named by the Library of Congress to the National Film Registry to ensure that it is preserved for all time. Undead forever. Power up on spinach to fight them off. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. What do you think happens in the local public school cafeteria when a child forgets his lunch money? Well, it depends on where you live. Some schools will feed that child anyway. In some district, he'll sit hungry while the other kids eat, because it turns out school lunch is a huge financial issue for those districts. Jennifer Strong reports.
Imagine how you'd feel if your six-year-old was denied food at school in front of her friends. That's what happened to Dee Charles's daughter in East Orange, New Jersey.
She had her tray in her hand, and when she got to the lunch counter, the monitor told her that she was not allowed to eat because her account was not up to date.
The first grader went to another room to call her mom. School staff then realized she did have money in her account, and so they fed her. Charles and her husband left work and went to the school anyway. There, they were shocked to find a room of kids who couldn't pay for a reduced-price meal. That lunch cost 40 cents.
The principal then informed us she spoke to the parents on the first day of school and that it was their responsibility to make sure that their kids were fed.
East Orange is a low-income community with a big lunchroom debt. Victor Deming is on the Board of Education.
The deficit actually comes as a result of students not paying for meals, a little over $200,000.
That's $200,000 this school district can't afford. So even in kindergarten, no money can equal no food. There are lots of reasons a child's lunch account may be in the red. Parents are busy people and may simply forget to check the balance. Financial situations change, but some kids don't bring lunch money for a month or even the whole year.
USDA advises schools that they're not obligated to provide meals to children who forget their lunch money.
Diane Pratt-Havner is with the School Nutrition Association. She says there's very little government guidance. In many states, debt collectors go after parents with unpaid bills. Some districts hold report cards or deny access to school activities.
Many schools struggle to come to a consensus on how to respond when unpaid meal charges balloon out of control.
New York City is the most extreme example. Unlike New Jersey, children without lunch money don't go hungry, but that comes at a huge expense. Over the course of 8 years, the price tag for unpaid meals famously topped $42 million. That's according to New York City's education department. Still, if there's anything everyone agreed on, there's also a cost to hungry kids. Victor Deming.
Children who are hungry do not do well in school, and quite frankly, our energy here is to provide instruction to all of our young people.
Schools all over the country are choosing between two bad options, piles of debt or hungry kids. In Washington, I'm Jennifer Strong for Marketplace.
If you find yourself sitting on the next great idea for a whiz-bang internet company, Alexis Ohanian might be a good person for you to talk to. He's a co-founder of Reddit, which is an online social news website that had about 75 million visitors last month, give or take a couple of million. He's also the author of a new book called Without Their Permission, about his own experiences starting a company on the internet, companies, actually, and why you ought to join the party, too. Alexis, thanks for being here.
Very happy to be here, Kai.
I'm trying to figure out what this book is, man. It's part memoir from a 30-year-old guy. It's part manifesto, and it's part, how-to, basically, right?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. I've been really fortunate with a lot of the success that I've had, and there is something special going on here, thanks to the internet, which I'm pretty much convinced is not a fad. And I just want as many people as possible to basically be awesome on it. It's exciting to me because there's a lot riding on it. Obviously, from an economic standpoint, there aren't a lot of industries in the world that America still dominates in. But, the internet and tech there is one of the few, right? The world uses Google. The world uses Facebook. One of the healthiest parts of our economy right now is the tech sector. And although I'm very excited to inspire a generation of entrepreneurs there, it's also about all the people who are going to create great things on those platforms. It's another generation of artists using Kickstarter to have films come to fruition. It's another generation of writers building an audience and getting to produce their work. And it's exciting. It really is.
Do they have to be young people? I mean, part of the thing that you talk about is how, you're a native and you grew up with this and you've got it figured out. But is it open to others? You make a big show out of the internet being open.
It is absolutely open. And really, the power comes from the fact that if you wanted to participate in the Industrial Revolution, you need to open a factory. And if you want to participate in the Internet Revolution, you only need to open a laptop. And that doesn't have any age requirements.
Okay. So if the barriers to entry are as low as they obviously are, and if you don't necessarily need to know what you're doing on the Internet to make a gazillion dollars, how come we're not all Internet gazillionaires?
Well, because like anything in life, it is not that easy. There is the barriers are indeed low. This is the gift and the curse, as to paraphrase Jay-Z. The gift, right, is anyone can get online. You got to give respect.
You got it, man. No, I get it.
And when anyone can have that, stage, so to speak, for their ideas, that's great because it means anyone can have a stage. It is also a problem because anyone can have a stage, and thus there is a lot more noise.
I'll just come out and say it. You guys didn't know what you were doing when you started Reddit, and you are very upfront about that. But that was eons ago in internet time. Can you still not know what you're doing? Just wing it and get away with it, starting a business on the internet?
Yes, and I'll tell you, I think not enough of us who have had some success are willing to really admit how little we actually know about what we're doing. Yes, yes, you know, past experience helps. But at the end of the day, if we're not constantly pushing ourselves to get into positions where we're doing something a little different or a little out of the ordinary that makes us a little uncomfortable, we're not really growing. And the sooner we come to terms with that, the better, because then we can actually start pushing boundaries, but I actually start innovating and doing new stuff because there is no precedent.
One more thing before I let you go. Do you find any irony in the fact that you, internet entrepreneur guy, actually wound up with a printed book on paper to get your message in?
You know, I, as someone who also started a book publisher, I love the smell of books. I love the smell of it. It is a wee bit ironic. I'll grant you that. But I'll tell you, if my apartment is any evidence, you know, I still have way too many books, if there is such a thing. So I'm quite content with that irony.
Alexis Ohanian, his book is called Without Their Permission. You might have heard of a company he started. It's called Reddit. Alexis, thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much, Guy.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the phrase time is money, people, is established once again as a truism from the 2013 drive-through performance study by the fast food trade publication QSR Magazine. This tidbit today: the average McDonald's drive-through time is 189 and a half seconds. That's how long people wait. A tad more than 3 minutes. It matters because the big chains do 60 to 70% of their business at the drive-thru, of course. The record? Wendy's, back in 2003, 116 seconds, less than 2 minutes. Nobody has been close to that since. So there you go. We're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 128 points, 0.8% as the shutdown looms. The NASDAQ off 10 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 also down 10 points, about 0.6%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Raghu Manavalan. Millie Jefferson directs the show. Chow Tu is our digital producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.